Welcome to Out There with TJ Ryan. It's strange. It's unusual. It's mysterious. It's out there, out there, out there, out there. And now your host, TJ Ryan.
You know, I have to thank Michelle, who is always sending me things. She works with a PR group, and a lot of interesting things. There's so many people out there saying so many things, and some of which I'm interested in, and I'm interested in the unknown. Let's just be honest. I've always been interested in, you know, some of it's paranormal, metaphysical, some of it's natural, just whatever. I think there are things that are hidden from us, and whether it's deliberate or just there's truths out there that are always being, we're finding. And so when I heard about Michael Wood, I really was interested in what he had to say. Now, Michael's from Miami. He's written several books, and he is a cryptographer. He's gone back in the Bible, and he's gone back to the earliest messages and looked at things differently because they just don't seem to make a lot of sense. So Michael's with me today. How are you doing, Mike?
Doing great, thanks. And how are you doing?
I'm doing fabulous, and it's good to talk to you. You're in Miami, Florida, so it's got to be pretty nice most of the time there, right?
Yes, it is. That's why I moved here.
Now, where are you from originally?
New York. Big difference in weather.
I think so, slightly. And how did you grow up? Were you like a Christian? Did you grow up with Christian teaching?
I sure did. My dad is a minister of the Nazarene denomination, which is a holiness church. Mm-hmm. And so I not only grew up in the church, but I myself fell in love with the Bible.
And at one point, obviously, like it is for me and a lot of people, there are things in the Bible that you look at and you go, "Now, wait a second, that just doesn't make sense." Or it says this and then it says that, right? There are things you had a question, right?
Well, I was totally confident that the underlying Greek must have a consistent message, but there's no denying that the conventional English translations contain a lot of inconsistencies that later as an adult, I learned that seminary textbooks acknowledge that there are issues that still confuse scholars, and that shows up in the inconsistencies in their translation. Again, Paul and all the other authors of the New Testament were consistent in the Greek, but boy, these English translations, I mean, at this point, I now realize they are awful.
And how many people have you know, looked at these things and think this is the absolute truth, and then we've judged others over it. And there's a couple of statements here that I looked at when I was getting information about this interview. I thought, wow, he's going to really rock some people's worlds with some of the things that you have to say. So how many years did you study?
Well, this has been a 12-year investigation, often 16 hours a day. I had the good fortune of retiring a little over 12 years ago, and I've spent basically full time and then some in this pursuit of finding out what were the original meanings of the first century words and symbols by applying my craft.
So how does that work? I don't even know what that means, cryptography.
Cryptography is the making and breaking of codes, and I was fortunate enough to design Redoc 2, the unbreakable code named Redoc 2. And designing an unbreakable code is kind of the number one goal in cryptography, so I was grateful to have made that achievement. And then cryptanalysis is actually code breaking. And what I did was, as a teenager, I'd memorized many of Paul's letters word for word in the New Testament. And as I said earlier, the English translation of his letters bothered me because once you memorize the conventional translations, you can't get away from the inconsistencies. Mm-hmm. If you're just reading, it's easy just to gloss right over them, almost as if they don't exist.
Right.
But once you memorize them, that's it. You come face to face with them. So I got curious. I decided to treat the Greek language as if it were a code. And, for example, in English, If we take the word sing, we can make sing, singing, singers, etc. All languages do that. The Greek is the same. You take a root, and you can make nouns, adjectives, verbs, etc. So well, let me pretend like we don't know the meaning of any of the roots. What would the roots have to mean in order for Matthew, John, and Paul, for example, to be saying the exact same thing without contradiction? Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Right,
I'm solving for the meaning, not based on, oh, here's a dictionary, but using cryptography to calculate what the meaning would be if we assume that they're saying the same thing. And that was the beginning of this project. And what popped out was something fascinating. According to the cryptanalysis, the number one word, the most important word in all the New Testament, has to deal with the word that's translated as righteousness.
Right.
And the reason why this is really important is that both Catholics and Protestants believe that the New Testament teaches salvation by righteousness, but they argue over how does one be seen as righteous before God. Catholics say that one must keep the Old Testament moral code, and Protestants say that one is God views people as righteous simply because they believe in Jesus. Now, here's the kicker. According to the cryptanalysis, the word didn't mean righteousness, so they've been arguing over the wrong thing.
Mm-hmm.
According to the cryptanalysis, the word must have meant loving kindness.
Really? That's so
important. Yeah.
That's so cool.
Well, which changes everything.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, have you had, and just getting off at just a brief moment, have you had, like, really cool experiences with, like, God or a higher power or things in your life? Has there ever been anything in your life, Michael?
Many times.
And do you feel, and this is why I like what you're saying. My experience, and it's happened to me a few times, this is a loving being. And that's all I feel, you know? Not a judgmental. To me, it's just this loving being. I don't see the rest of this. I never have.
Well, in the New Testament, says that. That is, going back to that word, what happened was, people are going to say, well, if cryptanalysis says it, what about the translation dictionaries? They say it means righteousness.
Mm-hmm.
So I hired a Greek scholar, and I pointed to Romans 2:26. I said, this word used here, Paul is talking about the commandments based on loving kindness. He said, that's not what the word means. I said, I understand that the dictionary say otherwise, but I'd like to hire you at double your rate to go back through the early Koine Greek material and see if they used it in this way that I'm saying. He said, well, they didn't. I'll save you your money. I said, please. I said, can I hire you? He said, I really don't want to waste your money. I said, humor me. I won't be disappointed. He came back 2 weeks later. He said, oh, my God, you've uncovered a meaning that no one knew. In fact, in the amount of documentation that the word was used this way was overwhelming.
Mm-hmm.
So then I went through the entire laundry list of what the cryptanalysis said the words meant, and one by one, they all matched exactly. And so going back to this loving being, as you are talking about, so here is what Matthew wrote. Matthew wrote, unless your loving kindness is greater than the scribes and the Pharisees, you cannot enter God's kingdom. In modern Bibles, that reads, unless your righteousness is greater than the scribes and the Pharisees. Mm-hmm. But what a difference. And Matthew wrote, seek first God's kingdom and his loving kindness, and all of these things will be added unto you. Not righteousness again. So all throughout Matthew, Paul, and John, they were all describing God as love, and that everyone who loves is born of God.
Mm-hmm. I already become that. You become that. You enter into that by embracing that. It's kind of the way I've always looked at it.
Well, and the good news is that the New Testament in the Greek says exactly as you've experienced, and that's the thing, when you experience God and you see people through God's eyes, you know that he is love, but the good news is that the New Testament authors, they all knew God intimately, and when their writings are translated accurately, the New Testament is the most loving, most inspirational book written so far.
Now, there are things that you may claim to, and I'm sure you have several things, but I'm looking at this information. And one of them, you know, some people have had fear of eternal damnation in hell. And you found that that's not accurate.
Well, there's a lot of great books that accurately show that during the first 400 years of the faith, the New Testament was written in Greek. And that's very important because the first 400 years of the faith, every native Greek-speaking seminary solely taught temporary punishment. This means when they're reading the New Testament in their native language, they were seeing temporary punishment, not eternal. What my research focused on, there's many great books that document that and discuss that aspect of Christian history. What I was fascinated with was that starting at the beginning of the 5th century, almost every church taught temporary punishment, almost every seminary taught temporary punishment, and almost every lay person believed in temporary punishment. Yet by the end of the 5th century, the reverse was true. Almost every Christian believed in eternal damnation. So I was curious, what happened in the 5th century that the Christian faith underwent such a wholesale change regarding this doctrine?
Mm-hmm.
And that's when I found Jerome at the very center of all of this. When Jerome was the man who was commissioned to translate the Bible from Greek into Latin because Greek was no longer the common tongue, but Latin was. And what Jerome basically translated all the passages related to punishment as eternal punishment, and from letters that he had written and books that he had written, we've been able to identify that he intentionally misled the Christian community.
Mm.
And that's why I used the word conspiracy in a book that I wrote, The Jerome Conspiracy.
Now, was he... Michael. Was he under Constantine? Was that around that time?
I want to say... I always get the... I want to say Augustine. And Jerome. I have to go back. The Jerome Conspiracy was the first work that I wrote so many years ago. And so I forget who he was conversing with, but his letters show, his letters combined with the Dead Sea Scrolls, by the way,
right,
show that he misled the Christian community. Would you like to know how we can say that with certainty? Because conspiracy is a strong word.
Mm-hmm.
Jerome, when he was translating the Latin Vulgate, up until that time, the Christians used a Greek version of the Jewish scriptures called the Septuagint. And the Septuagint was translated from the Egyptian Jews' version of scripture. Jerome insisted on using a brand new version of the Old Testament. Now, here's what most Christians do not realize. For the first 500 years of the faith, there was a different version of the Old Testament than the one that's in modern Bibles today. The swap occurred in the 5th century. So Jerome wrote, the Christians were so mad at Jerome that he wrote a book to defend his choice, and his book Apology 2. And his claims about what were in his Hebrew manuscript, no one could refute or deny because we didn't have access to his Hebrew manuscript. But it turns out that the Dead Sea Scrolls solved that problem. The Dead Sea Scrolls show that the Babylonian version of the Jewish scriptures remained identical almost to the word and to the letter for over 1,000 years persistence. Jerome translated from that version of the Hebrew scriptures, so thanks to the Dead Sea Scrolls, we know exactly the manuscript he had in his hands, and when we read his defense that he wrote and compare it, we can see he lied through and through. So he foisted upon Christianity this change in the Old Testament, and the reason why that's significant is that the Egyptian version of the Jewish scriptures talked about universal salvation, that the Messiah is going to reconcile the entire world to God, whereas the Babylonian is more of a damnation-oriented, and that facilitated the changes he made to the New Testament. So it really was a concerted effort, and he won. He got the Christian faith to switch from temporary punishment to eternal punishment, and modern conventional translations have carried over his mistranslation.
So you're almost saying that there is no eternal damnation and that maybe we all go on at some point?
Well, that's what the original New Testament Greek says. That's what the ancient Jews didn't believe in by and large, in eternal punishment. They believed solely in a place of purgatory that they called Gehenna. Gehenna is the word that's used by Matthew. And the whole point of Gehenna is that basically that there's two ways to get to God. There's the hard way, and then there's the easy way.
Mm-hmm.
But there was never the notion that people would be eternally separated from God. And so Christianity saw Jesus, his sacrifice on the cross, as the redemption of the entire world. And the New Testament, for example, Paul proclaims that everyone in Gehenna will eventually swear to Jesus as their master. In Philippians, he wrote in 1 Corinthians that everyone, as in Adam, all die, so also in Christ all shall be made alive, but each in their own order, which the early Christians took to understand as that everyone will be reconciled to God.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was the... What is ironic is that Origen, the Alexandrian seminary, was very allegorical. It interpreted the Bible symbolically, whereas the school in Antioch, they translated the Bible very literally. So they differed on so many doctrines, but the one thing they agreed on was temporary punishment. Because no matter how you looked at the Greek text, whether you're looking at it allegorically, literally, any way you slice or dice it, temporary punishment.
Makes a lot of sense to me. I just never really felt, even as when I was younger, I just never really felt there was a hell. And now I hear about this from you. And to me, I think a loving God. I can't see this loving God doing that to us. So I really like that. Now here we're going to go down a course where you're bound to upset some people that believe in certain things. And you talk about how homosexuality, premarital sex, how are those regarded in the early understanding or the Greek understanding?
Okay, let's start first with homosexuality. And in the New Testament, modern Christians believe that there are three references to homosexuality, all three written by Paul. Well, two of those references are 1 Corinthians 6:9 and 1 Timothy 1:9. But in those passages in the Greek, Paul used the Greek word that referred quite specifically to the rapists of young boys, not homosexuals.
Hmm.
At the time Paul wrote his letters, raping young boys was actually more popular than having sex with women.
Wow.
Raping slave boys was considered the in thing, so much so that the wealthy had a stock of slave boys that they solely used. Their sole function in life was for the sexual pleasure of the master, and the uber wealthy even had slaves whose sole function was to keep the stock of slave boys pretty for the master.
Hmm.
And I believe it was Marshall who wrote the satire that the sons get busy raping the slave boys on the night of their father's death. It's just that raping slave boys was the common thing of the day. And all of the Christian writings that use that word around that time period solely use that word in reference to raping slave boys. The second century Christians invented a synonym for that word, a synonym which literally meant corrupter of young boys. As late as the 15th or 16th century, I always get the centuries wrong, the German monk Martin Luther, when he translated the Bible from Greek into German, he translated those passages as referring to the rapists of young boys. He did that because the Greek-German translation dictionaries of his day solely included that as the one meaning, because that was the one meaning of the word.
Mm-hmm.
Even as late as the early 1900s, when Robert Donaldson translated Christian writings into English, they translated that word as rapists of young boys. And so what happened is this idea that no homosexual shall enter the kingdom of God, that modern mistranslation is a new thing. It's a rewrite of the word solely based on a theological agenda against the actual meaning of the word, as all of history attests. And so 1 Corinthians 6:9 and 1 Corinthians 1:9 do say that the rapist of young boys shall not enter God's kingdom, and rightfully so, because that is a massive and grotesque violation of loving our neighbors as ourselves. So that leaves us now with one reference to adult same-sex acts, and that's in Romans. And you know what? That passage is even more fascinating.
What does it have to say, Mike?
Oh, well, in Romans, Paul is chastising fellow Jews who happen to believe that their piety exonerates them before God while they are treating others cruelly. In the passage, they're stealing, plundering temples, and doing all these other things. So the first century Jews considered homosexuality to be a vile form of impiety, one worthy of death. Multiple documents, I mean, they bragged about their stance on homosexuals deserving death. So Paul wrote Romans and turned the tables on his fellow countrymen. He starts off Romans by saying that even homosexual orgies committed in pagan temples solely results, that orgiastic behavior solely results in a psychophysical disturbance received in the self. Then he continues on to say, only the unethical treatment of others is worthy of death, and you guys are guilty of this unethical treatment, so you will incur God's wrath on the day when God judges all humanity according to the benevolence of their deeds. Paul defended homosexuals against the religious people who believed homosexuality was mortal sin. The great irony is that Apostle Paul, defender of homosexuals.
That's really interesting. And I think, you know, we are starting to wake up to see that, aren't we? People are starting to, well, not just starting to, we really are beginning to see that. How can you judge others for that? You know, to me, it's like we're all the children of God. And if we love others, who are we to sit in judgment of them, are we?
Well, all the surveys show that in America, that the vast majority of the people who are against same-sex marriage appeal to Paul's writings. And the irony is that it's the Apostle Paul. He actually used the Greek verb, which meant to know, and he kept talking about to know God throughout the passage. His message to his fellow countrymen was amazing and profound. The passage says, if you think that homosexuality is worthy of spiritual death, then you don't know God. And that message really needs to be brought out to those who are misusing Paul's writings to now teach the opposite of what he wrote.
Right.
He was the first to say, if you think that any impiety at all, including homosexual orgies in pagan temples, he brought up that combination as saying that has nothing to do with Judgment Day, because the only thing that matters is the unkind treatment of others. Oh, and by the way, if your listeners, I prepared a sheet for your listeners on this specific topic so that they can get all the details just on a download that they can get free of charge. Can I give the location of
Absolutely.
That? They go to Michael Wood Cryptographer and go to the downloads page. There is all the documentation there so that everyone can get more, understand what Paul was writing there much more in depth than we could possibly cover on a radio interview.
Well, I just think it's, you know, we're seeing a lot of people appearing to be waking up. Do you feel that way, Michael? A lot of people are waking up and thinking differently across the world. And we're starting to see, I think, more compassion for everybody and everything. Do you not feel that at all, Michael?
I do. And I think that what has to happen, and the nice thing that's going to happen, is that many Christians feel caught between waking up in their hearts to this, wow, all this compassion and love and mercy for everyone, and trying to reconcile it with what they've been told the mm-hmm. New Testament says.
Mm-hmm.
And the nice thing is that there's nothing to reconcile, because the New Testament has been trying to wake people up to this anyway ever since it was written.
You also go on to say something about the premarital. What is the?
Oh, yes. Okay. This was a very fun one. According to the original cryptanalysis, it doesn't say that the sexually immoral cannot enter God's kingdom, but rather those who have sex with other men's women cannot enter God's kingdom. And that was another one that stunned the scholars, because in the book, I dedicate dozens of pages, the amount of documentation that word specifically referenced those who have sex with other men's women is astounding. Hmm. And yet in conventional translations, it gets translated as a broad basket term, sexual immorality or fornication, such as premarital sex. Yet Paul solely condemned, back in his day, the great sins were having sex with another man's woman, and then the Jews considered homosexuality. Mm-hmm. Paul came down in the defense of the homosexuals, but he affirmed that having sex with another man's woman still remained as the great sin, because that's still unethical. You're still cheating another. And if people look in 1 Thessalonians 4, they'll see a great example where Paul says, don't have sex with other men's wives because you cheat and defraud a brother in the process. Many Bibles say don't engage in fornication, which would be premarital sex, because you cheat and defraud a brother in the process.
Right.
That doesn't make sense.
No, it doesn't.
Unless
you're engaging with that brother. I mean, it doesn't make a lot of
sense.
Right.
It shows that there's a mistranslation there. And so if folks look at 1 Thessalonians 4, they'll see that the Greek must be referring to sex with another man's woman, and that unlocks the rest of the things that Paul wrote.
What about the reference to 666 in the Bible?
You know, that is an amazing one, because I grew up in a church where I saw movies about the end times and everyone has to wear get 666 engraved on their skin, or else you can't buy or sell, you're going to starve to death, etc. And the irony is that prior to 70 CE, all Jewish contracts were written in Aramaic. Now, the reason why this is significant is that the Aramaic symbols represented both letters and numbers at the same time, and every contract had to put the Aramaic symbols representing the emperor, the currently reigning emperor. So that means during Nero's reign, the Aramaic symbols that represented him also were the number 666.
Hmm.
So on every contract, every marriage contract had 666 on it, every divorce contract had 666 on it, every contract to buy seeds, every contract to sell the produce, 666 was part and parcel of everyday life in Jewish life because of the Aramaic contracts. And so John actually used an idiom that gets mistranslated in Revelation. The idiom meant anybody with common sense or anybody with half a brain. So what John wrote in the Greek was, let anybody with half a brain sum the number of the beast, where the number is that of a man and his number is 666. John, the number was so part and parcel of the culture that he expected everybody to know it. Therefore, it's not about a future person. It was solely about Nero. And the reason why he said you couldn't buy or sell without either the image or 666, the number, mm-hmm. was that the number 666 was on every contract, and Nero's image was on all the popular coins of the day. So you literally couldn't buy or sell at that time without either the image of the beast or the number of his name.
Hmm. That's interesting. That's really interesting, because there's always been that great debate about what does that mean. And I think a lot of people have put a lot of different spins on it. So those are really fascinating. So what do you think the overall message is that they're trying to tell us, the authors of the New Testament? What is their message?
Well, all of them wrote that love your neighbor as yourself is the totality of Jesus' law, and therefore brotherly love alone will matter on Judgment Day. I was talking to a scholar who famously wrote, and I won't give his name, but basically he wrote that Matthew and Paul could never possibly work out their differences regarding law. And so I asked him, I said, well, Paul wrote in Romans 13, 8 through 9, that love your neighbor as yourself is the totality of Jesus' law. Matthew taught the same thing in Matthew 19, 16 through 19, that all the commandments based on love your neighbor as yourself are the entire law. What's there to even reconcile?
Right.
He sat there, he's like, I said, please, tell me in either of their writings, which of them ever went against their own teaching that love your neighbor as yourself is the entire law? And he said, and he was dumbfounded because they're looking in the wrong area. They're looking for faith or something else. But the moment you accept that it's about brotherly love, then you see that Matthew taught the same thing as Paul. And by the way, many Christians talk about Paul versus James. In James chapter 2, James wrote that the precept, love your neighbor as yourself, is the king's law. And then he continues on to explain, that's why compassion alone will matter on judgment day. So there's nothing to reconcile between Matthew, Paul, and James. They all taught the same thing. The only thing that matters to God is how we treat each other.
Now you're talking about judgment day, and you're talking about, you know, that there will come a time. But even then, judgment day is different than what we think. It's not about this damnation. Again, going back to that. There's going to be a price to pay. There may be a price to pay, but it's not going to be an eternal price to pay, is there?
Not according to the Greek New Testament. A great place to look for an example of this is Matthew 5, where Jesus says that people get out after they pay the last penny. And if you look at the context of that statement, even in conventional Bibles, which use the word hell, which wasn't in the original Greek, you see that the getting out after you pay the last penny is Jesus' parable about quote-unquote hellfire. So I was talking to some Christians. They said, oh, well, yes, he said you get out after you pay the last penny, but that's because our sins are so great, even in eternity won't cover them. And so I point them back to this particular passage because what Jesus said is that the reason people went into the hellfire in this passage is just because they call somebody a fool. It's the opposite of this great load of sin. Jesus was talking about the tiniest possible infraction. So there is no wiggle room around it. Jesus taught that people get out of the fire after they pay the last penny, and the good news is all the New Testament authors followed suit.
Well, you know, it's just really fascinating. Have you received any heat over this?
Even to the point of people calling for my death. And
really?
Oh, of course. And when it comes to issues of religion, that is, I used to avoid email for a while, and I even had to remove my email address from my website because the degree of venom and hatred is, and my heart goes out to these people because they're responding from emotion, but at the same time, you know, when I've shared with people who then have realized there is no eternal damnation and they've been upset, I said, this right here shows the problem of modern religious view of the New Testament. You are upset that people aren't going to suffer for all eternity in hell.
Boy, that just disappoints me that they're not going to burn.
but I mean, literally crying, upset, not eating, not sleeping, just so upset about that idea that somehow, instead of rejoicing, when I learned this is what the New Testament taught, I remember it was the happiest, like this flood of joy overwhelmed me. I said,
you had an epiphany. God changed in your viewpoint at that point, right, Michael? You saw God in a different way.
Well, I always saw him that way, and I couldn't reconcile. I'm like, okay. God, I'll take care of them if you don't want to, but I know you want to, so something's wrong.
Right. Okay, so you've always felt that way, just like I have in my heart, that a being of love, I have love for a lot of people, almost all the time, everybody I meet, and my own family especially, you're very strong with. And if my son did something wrong, I always say this to people, I'm not going to cast him to hell. There's no way. I'd forgive him. He might have to learn from what he did, you know, but why would you throw that away? And for somebody making a mistake for eternity, that doesn't make, it never made sense to me. It never made sense to me, Michael. So is there anything else you want to add to this interview?
Oh, I think we've covered most of the talking points, as they say, and I'm grateful for that because all of them connect together back to that God does view all of humanity as his children. And as you are with your son, if you misbehave, the sole point of any punishment is to course correct. And the moment that you're course corrected, that's the end of the punishment.
It's done out of love, isn't it, Michael? It's done
always,
out of love.
All things.
All things are done. You and I can totally agree on that. Always done. And so there's like these universal laws we have that are really there to keep us in line. So we can kind of go back and learn a little bit.
Or learn a lot. Some of us.
Well, it's a never-ending thing, it seems like. Well, I'm, you know, it's too bad you got some heat for it, but I guess sometimes you got to stick your neck out. And in this day and age, wars are fought over. I mean, it's been this way for thousands of years. Wars have fought over these things. People are killed over these things. People are humiliated or hunted down because of their... And it's too bad. You know, I believe there's going to come a day when we will stop taking these things so seriously and we will start to see it in a, from a viewpoint of love. And I think what you're doing is going to go a long way in that direction. So thank you very much, Michael.
And thank you.
Music on Out There, created by Kevin MacLeod.